All right, well, thank you. As our group was coming together and thinking about this, this boot camp is sort of like, we had in mind people who might be new to injury epidemiology and not really be familiar with what tools are available or things that are available. So what you're going to be hearing is sort of a potpourri of talks at various sort of levels in terms of sophistication around injury data and injury surveillance and methodology and that sort of thing. So we're starting off with sort of the basics, and it has to do with online data sources for injury data. And so if you're a new epidemiologist in the field of injury, this is a place where you can start playing with some injury data that's available online. So one thing I wanted to make sure that people were aware of is that there is a website, if I can get it to move forward. So at this particular web page is a listing of a lot of the different national injury data systems that are available, and it's a nice description of about 45 different data systems that provide injury data. And it's at all different kinds of levels. Some of it is survey data, such as BRFSS or WIRE-VS. It describes systems that include deaths, EDs, hospitalizations, EMS, and pre-hospital, and all different types of injury mechanisms. So if you're interested in just sort of getting a feel for what types of injury data are available, this is a good website to look at. I have the URL up there, but another way to find it, for those of you who are familiar with the WSCRS website, if you go to the WSCRS website, there's a little box down in the lower right-hand corner that talks about sort of technical information or notes or something like that. And if you go there and click on that, you can also get to this webpage. But in any event, it's a good way to sort of get an overview of different types of data systems around injury. I'm going to be speaking about three systems in particular, WSCRS, Wonder, and the Health Indicators Warehouse, and so I'll go into a little bit of detail on each of these. So WSCRS is probably the one that most people have heard of or worked with before. It's the web-based injury statistics query and reporting system. And this particular website gives you information about injury deaths as well as non-fatal injuries. For the injury deaths, you can actually get down into state-specific information. For the non-fatal injuries, you can only get national estimates. But in addition to getting some information about injuries, deaths, and non-fatals, there are some modules that tell you about the cost of injury, so that can be very helpful. There's a mapping feature, and then there's data tables that show you how injury ranks in comparison to other leading causes of death. And within the last couple of years, there's now a mobile app that's been developed that works on your iPad or, I believe, even on your iPhone. So if you want to go out and impress your friends saying, what do the deaths in your state look like, you can be the total geek and pull up your WSCRS app and say thank you to Lee Annest, who just retired, for giving that capability to you. In the world of WSCRS, again, it's an online query system, so you're able to select by age, and it can be standard age groups or customized age groups. You can look at things by sex, by race, ethnicity, intent of injury, and mechanism of injury. And then for the non-fatals, because it's based off of emergency department data, it tells you the disposition, so whether or not people were just treated in the emergency department and then released, or were they hospitalized, or were they transferred to another hospital, or did they leave the emergency department against medical advice? There's a variety of different options there. So there are different choices there when it comes to the non-fatal. So what I wanted to do is just show you some examples of the types of things that you can generate using the data off of WSCRS. So this is an example of the mapping feature, where you can relatively easily create a map with the age-adjusted rates for deaths due to fire and burns. And one of the limitations of the mapping feature in WSCRS is that the data are a little bit old. At the time that I generated this, which was probably in the last month, the latest data that was up was 2004 to 2010, and clearly we have more recent data available. So a little bit limitation in the maps, but you can generate them relatively quickly, and you can sort of see geographic patterns or compare your state to other states quickly. This is one of the tables I was talking to you about the leading causes of death. I picked Colorado because I used to work in Colorado, and I would be able to sort of say, yeah, that makes sense, or no, it doesn't, so that's the reason why I picked Colorado. But this shows you the ranking of the top 10 leading causes of death in Colorado by age group. And the colored boxes are the different intents of injury. So you can see yellow is the unintentional, and the green is the suicide, and the orange color is homicide. And clearly you can, you know, I think we're pretty familiar with that statement that, you know, injury is the leading cause of death for ages 1 to 44, and it's true in Colorado as well. Unintentional injury ranks number 3 in our state. Suicide ranks number 7. And then it also has a feature where, what if you just want to rank within the world of injury? So this is just looking at injury mechanisms. It isn't taking into account all those other causes of death, but within the world of leading causes of injury death, what does the pattern look like? And again, here you can sort of see in Colorado for all ages, the leading cause of injury death in Colorado is fall, and then unintentional poisoning is number 2, and then firearm suicides are number 3. So again, relatively quickly you can get a profile of your state in terms of injury death. This is an example of the cost module, and on this one I looked at non-fatal dog bite injuries treated in emergency departments, and I only selected the subset of patients who are treated and released from the emergency department, so these are not people who are hospitalized. Interesting, in 2010, there were over 330,000 non-fatal dog bite injuries, and then of course they break out the medical cost and the work loss cost and then the combined cost. So between the two, it was $1.8 billion for treatment of non-fatal dog bite injuries in the U.S. One of the things that's useful here is if you see the rows where it says average, that's the average cost or medical cost or the average work loss cost. So if you have the number of ED visits in your own state, you can obviously apply that number to that cost and come up with numbers, cost numbers specifically for your state. You can't do that within Whiskers, but you know, you can use the information from Whiskers to come up with some estimates for your state. Here's the last plug for the Whiskers mobile app. I told Lee I would do it. I want to move on to another data set called WONDER, and I didn't even know that WONDER had was an acronym for something else, which is Wide-Ranging Online Data for Epi Research. There's a variety of different data sets that are available on WONDER, but probably the one that injury folks would use the most is the mortality data. And WONDER is a little bit different than Whiskers. It's the same data set, but the way WONDER is set up, it allows for more recent data, and so you can create more up-to-date maps using WONDER. And in addition to the selection criteria of age, sex, race, ethnicity, you can look at some other things like rates by urbanization, by month, day of the week, by autopsy status, by place where the death occurred. And then because you have the option of selecting specific underlying or multiple cause codes, you can get very specific in terms of the types of deaths that you're looking at. In the Whiskers world, you basically pick a category. So I want motor vehicle, or I want drowning, or I want falls. But here you can get into a lot more detail if you have some knowledge about the ICD-10 codes for different injury mechanism categories. So again, just to show you some examples, this is drug poisoning deaths by urbanicity. This is for the whole of the U.S., and this is the latest data available from 2013. And what you can see is that the rates for the large metro areas is actually lower than for some of the other urban areas. This was sort of interesting. This was looking at suicides by day of the week, and this was combining data over 4 years and looking at the percent of suicides, total suicides, that happen on any given day of the week. And for the U.S. overall, the highest proportion is on Mondays. In Colorado, the highest proportion is on Tuesdays. So I don't know what that means, but it's a nice little factoid to amaze your friends. So, you know, it's interesting the types of things that you can look at. Here's an example of where you can get down to very specific pieces of information. On Whiskers, you can pick the broad category of drowning, but it includes drowning of all types. So if it's in a natural body of water, if it's in a swimming pool, it's in a bucket, it's in a fountain, it's in a whatever, it's all grouped together as drowning. Here, if you know the particular ICD-10 codes for drowning in natural bodies of water, you can specifically look at that. And so here was an interesting map that looked at death rates for drowning in natural bodies of water. And then here's one that we've seen a bazillion times at this conference. But again, by knowing the specific ICD codes, you can get down to specific types of drugs. And again, looking at the trends over time in terms of what's been happening in terms of opioid analgesics and what's been happening most recently in terms of heroin. So the last online data set I want to talk about in some detail is the Health Indicators Warehouse. This is also a data set that is queryable online, and it's maintained by the National Center for Health Statistics. There's up to 78 injury and violence indicators in there, and most of those indicators are related to the Healthy People 2020 objectives. So there are a lot of indicators that are related to the mortality data, the same types of information that you can get off of Whiskers and Wonder. But there are also a lot of indicators that come from the YRBS. And so because of that, you can actually get state-specific information for those YRBS-related indicators. So the ones that I have listed here are all available online that you can query. And again, just as a very brief example of this, this one is looking at suicide attempts requiring medical attention. And what I've shown here is just what the rates are for those states that are statistically higher than the national rate. So again, a way to sort of compare your state to a national norm. And if you happen to be in one of these categories, then you know, you're able to see that quickly using the Health Indicators Warehouse. So this is my contact information. I'm going to leave it up there for 15 seconds, and so there's no way you can copy it down. But you know, you always have to end your part of the presentation with your contact information, so there it is. Renee Johnson was going to give the next portion of this presentation, but unfortunately she didn't get approval to come to the CSTE conference, so I'm going to do my best to wing my way through her slides. So she did provide me notes, and so if I look at them quite frequently, it's just because I want to make sure I get it right. So what Renee was going to talk about are some of the injury surveillance tools that have been developed by the National Center for Injury Prevention and Control in association with the CORE VIPP program. And in particular, there are two injury surveillance tools to highlight. One is the State Injury Indicators, and the other is the Special Emphasis Reporting Tools. And the purpose of the state injury indicators is to sort of standardize injury surveillance methods so that there can be some comparison between states by making sure that everybody's doing the case selection the same way and putting their numbers in the same manner and doing the age adjustments in the same manner. So that's what the injury indicators is all about. The special emphasis report tools was a way to help states be able to take their data and prepare fact sheets and reports that would be useful for a variety of audiences. So let me talk about those in a little bit more detail. Injury indicators, as I mentioned, was there's a guidance document that tells you, you know, how to do the case selection, how to pull the data from the different data sets. The data sets that are looked at are death certificates, emergency department data, and hospitalization data. There are spreadsheets that all you have to do is put the numbers in and it automatically calculates out the age-adjusted rates for you. And then I believe that those spreadsheets end up being sent to CDC so that they sort of pull them together and create reports so that allows some comparisons between states. In terms of the special emphasis reports, there's actually four of them that have been developed. One of them is on infant and early childhood injury. So again, there's a guidance document, there's report templates, there's this alternate image file. So as you're creating your report for your state, if you want the look of it to be a little bit different, you have different choices in terms of some of the images or some of the graphs or those sorts of things. But it's a way to, for states that might not have the resources to be able to sort of generate a report relatively quickly, as long as they have the data to analyze. There's another one similar on traumatic brain injury, and this is what the cover of that one looks like. And then most recently there's been one on drug overdose deaths. In addition to the sort of standard components of the guidance document and reporting templates and the calculation spreadsheet, there's also additional information talking about things to consider when you're analyzing ICD-10 coded data on drug poisoning. For those of you who have been going to any of the drug poisoning sessions here at CSTE, you've heard a lot of comment about data quality and whether or not specific drugs are named on the death certificate and the implications of that. That particular component of the drug overdose death special emphasis report provides some guidance on things to think about in terms of data quality before you start and jump in and just work on the report. There's a one on fall injuries among older adults, which is supposed to be coming out sometime soon, so keep that on your radar. And again, I'm going to flash up a huge amount of contact information, but if you want to get the most recent versions of all of these, the person to contact is Karen Thomas, who also works at the National Center for Injury Prevention and Control, and here's her contact information. So with that, I think I'm going to turn it over to Tom, right? You're going to next.
Well, push the button, we'll see.
And we'll see. Okay. All right. I guess it'll be Tom.
Can you tell we practice?
Okay, well, as Holly just mentioned, one of the things we do as epidemiologists, when she mentioned the injury indicators, one of the things we do is states will generate data and submit that to a central site. So, for example, with injury indicators, we submit those to CDC. Also, if you're involved in an MMWR article, you might have a multi-state report, so you're generating data and submitting it to a central site. And as epidemiologists, we should be cognizant of the fact that our data should be accurate. That'd be something to strive for. But a lot of times when we generate our data, I don't know the degree to which you guys are as anal as I am, maybe by making sure my data is accurate. I'm very paranoid about sending anything out unless I've checked it 5 times. But what I want to do today is just talk about the use of something called a dummy data set to optimize accuracy. It's not to guarantee it's accurate, but to optimize the accuracy of data that you would submit in a multi-state submission. So here's what typically happens. Now, I have to apologize to people who don't use SAS, but anyway, here's generally what happens. You'll be sitting at your desk, and I intentionally made SAS a black box. So you and SAS are together, and the point is generate some data to be submitted to a central source, and you get a SAS log that says, hey, you're good. There's no red ink anywhere. It's good to go. And you get some output, and you say, I've got my injury indicators, or I've got whatever. I'm going to send that in. Well, that's, you know, a lot of times that's perfectly fine, but it's possible you can get no errors in your SAS log, and you still have a problem. So what the heck is dummy data? Well, it's a data set where you actually know it's created by you or whoever. There might be a central person who does that, and I can give you an example where I actually did it. But since I actually created the data set, I know what the right answer is. So that's what's so impressive about this. And so how do you go about creating this data set? Well, for example, with injury indicators, there's certain variables that you absolutely have to use in like the how-to guide. They'll tell you what you know, you need age or state of residence and these things. So those you have to have in the dummy data set, or else obviously you can't calculate the output. But I also, for real life, add extraneous variables just to possibly snag somebody. So obviously there's variables in whatever data set that are not going to be used, and that's what those extraneous variables are. So then there's lines that are created in a spreadsheet, and I know it sounds like it could take a long time, but I did this and it wasn't all that huge of a task actually. And what you can come up with 1,000, or you can come up with more than 1,000 cases, maybe 10,000 if you're doing a lot of copying and pasting, as long as you actually are keeping track of the true count. That's extremely important. And so also what you want to do, this is like a generic data set, so you'll want to provide the people with a coding scheme. So I'll go into that in a minute. So let's say this is 8 lines of data. I'm going to go into what the ID number is, but that's a unique identifying number for each line of data. Then you'll have a hospital ID number, and then you see I've just got three, this is for hospital discharge data, 3 diagnostic fields, discharge disposition, state of residence, age, sex, and admission source. So some of those are going to be key for generating data, let's say for injury indicators. And the thing about the ID number is if there's a if somebody submits data in and it's different from what the right answer is, we can do a process where we can figure out, oh, it was line number 3, you got that and I don't have it. Why is it that you got that? And we can say, hey, you accepted hospital ID, whatever, and you shouldn't have been. So here's just a coding scheme that you might use. So you might say 50 is the state of residence that you're gonna want, and then there's, I don't know, 1 through 9 might be some other state, and you throw in unknowns too. And your how-to guide may or may not say to include unknowns. So again, they're gonna have to get that right or they get the wrong answer. And for hospital ID, these are actually what I did use when I did this for the alcohol and other drug indicator process. But generally, you're gonna want in-state acute care hospitals, but I also included federal hospitals, out-of-state hospitals, and then non-acute care hospitals. So they're gonna need to code when they do their SAS coding or SPSS coding, they're gonna need to select the right places or they're gonna get the wrong answer. So as I mentioned, from April through June of 2014, we did this process because we were gonna write an MMWR on alcohol and other drug hospitalizations. So everybody was gonna submit their data to me and then we're gonna hopefully publish an MMWR. So we came up with a dummy data set and sent it out. There was 8 states that we sent the dummy data set and the coding scheme and the how-to guide. The way I did this was it's kind of a motivating factor. You couldn't submit the data, your real data to me unless the dummy data checked out. And if you didn't submit your data to me, you weren't an author on an MMWR. So people were pretty motivated to submit their dummy data. So of these 8 states, and every one of these epidemiologists is top notch, but there was only 2 states, and I'm not gonna mention who was right and who was wrong, but 2 of them were in the room who got this right, I believe. Anyway, 2 of them got it right, and 6 of them had slight errors in the results. So I knew the answer, and what they sent back to me was not correct. But eventually, by going through the process, they were able to figure out, oh, there's where the problem was, I see, because we would go and look at line 3, and they said, oh, well, why did I include disposition death or whatever it was? And so we worked through that, and they were able to eventually submit and get the correct answer. So again, it doesn't guarantee that their final submission is gonna be accurate, but maybe it's just one more way to increase or optimize the accuracy of submission. And so these are the 2 guys, my compadres, who helped me out in this process, Dan and Scott. So thanks, guys.
Good afternoon, I'm Barbara Gabella. I'm gonna talk about the Surveillance Quality Improvement Project. 4 states were funded. This is CDC funding to improve the quality of injury surveillance data. That's a big charge. And we're doing it by conducting state and multi-state projects. And there's my little disclaimer. So the example I'm going to talk about today is the multi-state project where we applied the ISW-7 poisoning recommendations. So in 2009, unintentional poisoning surpassed motor vehicle. I think we could quote this because we've seen it a lot today. And the Safe States Alliance convened experts to come up with recommendations. They released their report in 2012. There's the URL. And then the CSTE overdose subcommittee assessed the definitions applied to death. And if you were at the pre-conference workshop a couple of years ago or this one, you heard results from that effort. So the 4 SQI states, Massachusetts, Utah, North Carolina, and Colorado, decided to try and apply the recommended definitions to their own state data. And in some ways, listening to Tom's talk, I wish we had created a dummy data set. It would have helped us. So my talk today is focusing on hospitalizations and ED visits. We used only the primary diagnosis code and the primary E-code to select valid cases. And we were operationalizing primary diagnosis as the first diagnosis listed in the two data sources. We used the most recent calendar year of data. We selected state residents. We excluded admissions to hospitals from the indicators that were about emergency department visits. We selected all dispositions, including deaths. And in a way, this was an exploratory analysis. Could we apply those recommendations? So there are, let me go back. So this is option A. If you have looked at the report, there's also an option B, where you use the same criteria as A, except that you can use multiple diagnoses and E-codes. So the first thing we had to decide was, what is the maximum common number of fields across all four states in terms of diagnoses and E-codes? So for hospitalization, that was the first 9 diagnosis codes were common to all four states, and the first 6 E-codes. For emergency department visits, we limited it to the first 6 diagnosis codes, where we're going to search for the particular ICD-9-CM code, and then the first 6 E-code fields, where we were going to search for the recommended opioid poisoning codes. So here's the results. I'm going to let you look at it. Here it is for the acute opioid analgesic poisoning rates. And what I did was take that same table and try to look at the absolute difference between option A and B within a state, and then what proportion were the cases selected under option A method? What proportion did they represent of all the records or cases selected under option B? And then I did that again for the ED visits. So what you can see is some variability, though often Colorado and North Carolina look similar, and that Utah has a larger discrepancy between the two options. So because this was exploratory, we wanted to see if we could apply the recommended ICD-9-CM codes for these indicators. Really, what we found out about this was the limitations to comparability. And I called them structural. So it varied by state whether there was a state-mandated E-code that was required to be in the hospital discharge or in the ED visits file. Then it varied by state if E-codes were captured in the diagnosis field, in a designated ECO field, or in both types of field. Again, you see that there's differences among the four states. All of us were able to use the 6 ECOs and the 9 diagnosis fields, with the exception of North Carolina, where they have 1 designated E-code. We could use a similar method of selection for the... Oh, did I say that wrong? So it's the variation is on the hospital discharges. For the ED visits, we could use the same approach. And then Colorado didn't include patients who died in the ED in our analysis. And then, much like in Tom's talk, why he included different types of hospitals in the dummy data set is because you have to think about, is your data set really limited to acute care or hospitals? Often we want to limit our analysis to that because we're interested in the acute event, not necessarily the continued care. And then whether or not each state had the ability to identify
or exclude freestanding ED visits if necessary. And it turns out that Massachusetts, North Carolina, and Utah had freestanding emergency departments in their states and that they were reporting to these data files. So these are the kinds of things we had to think about and address in order to try to make our analysis methods comparable before we could look at the results. So in summary, we were expecting some differences across the states. We were able to run results for the indicators. There are differences, we think, in rates for opioid analgesics across the states, but I only showed those results. And for some of the other indicators in the ISW7, the differences weren't as large. So again, there may be value in your state in running all the indicators and not to make assumptions about all the different types of poisoning based on one or two indicators. Generally, the lowest opioid analgesic rates were in Colorado and North Carolina. So it really raised more questions than we answered. Does this indicate the influence of E-codes and whether they're mandated or not? Is it influenced by the number of possible E-codes per record? And does that vary by poisoning records versus other types of injuries? And again, we did not confirm these indicators, but in doing this analysis, it raises the question of whether or not we really are limited in the injury indicator method to the primary diagnosis or the first listed diagnosis. And then, is there anything that we as states should start talking about that we can do collectively to address some of these structural limits? Now I'm going to switch focus. So we do some multi-state projects. In fact, two of them have led to special emphasis reports, but here are just a laundry list of the state-specific projects for each state so that when you get the archive talk, you can contact that person if you're interested in how they did it. So in Colorado, we looked at driver versus passenger for motor vehicle traffic events, and how well or complete that is, how good that information is in our injury surveillance system. We've looked at the completeness of ED visits. We've looked at the positive predictive value of ICD-9 CM codes for trauma visits in 2012. And then we did a qualitative study of assigning injury ICD-10 CM codes to help prepare us in training mainly, but also how much time does it take to code ICD-10s again. We did a data dashboard for regional pharmaceutical opioid overdoses, heroin and benzodiazepine, and there's my contact information. Here's the list for Massachusetts. They have examined off-road vehicles. They've looked at fall from window. They've assessed the predictive value positive of ICD-9 codes for children ages 0 to 14 in their hospital and ED databases. They've assessed opioid poisonings and potential miscoding. They've assessed or compared ICD-9 CM and ICD-10 CM fall injuries for ages 65 and older. And I should say that all four states are doing that, but we're at different stages in that project. So Massachusetts is ahead of the three other states. And Beth Hume is overseeing and worked on these projects, and there's her contact information. Here's North Carolina. They've assessed, was that my ding?
No.
Nope, someone else's phone, okay. Just checking because I can see everyone's energy level drop. It's a lot, isn't it? It was a lot to put this together. Okay,
North Carolina has assessed missing E-codes, and they have a really cool slide that shows the improvement and how they improved it. They've looked at the quality of drowning data. They've looked at opioid overdoses. They've worked on creating uniform poisoning definitions. They've also identified barriers to accurate and complete e-coding. They have looked at the data quality around falls in the triage notes. And then you can see Scott added information on some of their dissemination. And there's his contact information. Here are the STI state projects for Utah. They've looked at external cause coding for injury, and they've also looked specifically at traumatic brain injury. They've looked at opioid overdose of suicide and undetermined intent. So again, trying to identify what's the quality and how to improve it. They also have conducted a naloxone study that was looking at survival rate comparisons of patients with administration of drug prior to or after their admission to the ED. And I believe Riley gave a talk last year about that here at CSTE. They also are working on the unspecified falls, and if there's enough information in the actual medical record to document a more specific fall type among the older adults. And there's Elizabeth's contact information.
We're almost there. So there was a list of people. I'm going to talk to you about a project we did that we do every year that's looking at some of the missing information. It's a collaboration between lots and lots of different entities, and so I wanted to list them here. As was mentioned earlier, kind of the core SQI project is for states, and its kind of mission is really to improve communication, collection, and usefulness of E-code injuries across data systems spectrum to inform surveillance and injury programs. So again, we not only have people that we collaborate with directly, but there's a bunch of different agencies and organizations. So you might not know the acronyms, but the first is North Carolina Hospital Association, North Carolina Institute of Medicine, North Carolina Health Information Technology, the North Carolina Division of Public Health, the Carolina Health Information System, Injury Prevention and Research Center, which is Steve Marshall, and the list goes on. So we've kind of gone to each entity and have these kind of different questions around some of the injury data that we've been trying to understand a little bit more. So the key partnership we have is really with NC Detect, which has been mentioned a lot in this particular conference, because if you do anything with syndromic surveillance for infectious disease, you know, there's whole sessions across the corridor around some of those things. We've been using our BioSense or our NC Detect as kind of injury surveillance tool, and so we've been working with them as a partner in some of these projects. We had a series of objectives for our state, and really the first one is the one that we're going to talk about today, which is assess the completeness of e-coding in some of the surveillance systems that we have. So really, the question is, well, why? Why are we bothering with emergency department data? Well, in North Carolina, you know, if you think of the injury iceberg here, we're talking about 1 million emergency department visits that are injury or violence related, relative to the other kinds of things, 160,000 hospitalizations, 6,000 deaths. So we've got 1 million that we want to make sure that the quality is high enough so that we can utilize that, because we use it for lots of different reports. And so we want to make sure that we have a high index of quality information that's going out. And much like Tom, we want our data to be really useful and accurate as possible. So one of the ways we've done that is to look at the completeness of e-coding in North Carolina. Here's a quick chart that just tells of those emergency department visits. In this case, there's a little bit more than 1 million because we're including some of the adverse effects. If you look at anything that's been diagnosed from 800 with a diagnosis code of 800 to 999, or have an E-code for 2011, you know, theoretically they should all have an E-code, right? All those diagnoses should have an E-code. Well, in our state, you know, if you look at the bar on the far right, only 73% have both an E-code or a diagnosis code and an E-code present. What's interesting is among some of those, 3.4% are actually missing the diagnosis code, even though there's an E-code present. Now, you don't get reimbursed for the E-code, so there's kind of a business case we've been trying to make that you're missing 3.4%, which doesn't sound like a lot until you talk about 1 million visits a year. So we tried to kind of look at it in another way too, where we were looking at, well, what was their kind of disposition? And, you know, we thought kind of immediately there would be some cases in which this would make sense. People who die, maybe the data quality isn't so great, maybe there's just, you know, lots of other things going on. But what we found interesting was the two bars about admitted in ICU, because technically they're just kind of passing through the ED and then they're being admitted to the hospital. And we've been trying to talk with folks on the ground about how this really works. You know, is it that they don't start some of the reporting because they know it's going to be admitted and they don't want to have to handle kind of the burden on their end? Or, you know, is it just some kind of miscommunication between kind of the process, admissions processes? So we've had some of those conversations, but probably not enough. But where it gets really interesting is this slide. And you may have seen it before. I've presented it in a couple of conferences in the past. But when we're looking at the missing data, you know, again, we're looking at the state level. But if you're looking at individual hospitals, so we have 123 now. And in 2011, we had about 117, I think, hospitals. And so across the bottom are the different hospitals, 1 to 115. And then who's missing the E-codes? Well, it's really just these like 12 that are missing 50% or more. So, you know, there's no real purpose in going back and concentrating on any of these other things. But then we got into this like legal hassle that I won't bother with here, but, you know, could we identify those hospitals and go directly to them about their the quality of their information, even though we had the information? The hospital association was just like, oh no, don't burden them, that will be a problem. So we finally negotiated some things because I think the hospitals want high quality data too. And in some cases we knew that there were like technical issues. It wasn't that the E-codes weren't there, it's that the feed wasn't coming to us. So what happened a year later after we actually did focus on some of these things? Well, some great things happened. A lot of those places got better. Now, I can't say that that was a direct result of some of our work. I'd like to say that, but I can't. And in one case it did get worse. But I will also tell you an unfortunate thing is, so this is 2011, 2012. So what happened in 2013? There's been a replacement. So as much as we have worked with some, and some of them have like moved down the spectrum, now we have a bunch more into the thing. But again, we can kind of prioritize the list, and it helps us a great deal because we can just kind of go to them directly. Now, I will say in the last 3 years, at least in our state, you've had these huge systems undergoing these huge kind of transformation with Health Exchange and, you know, I don't know about the rest of you, but between Censor and Epic, you know, we're like an Epic-dominated state at this point, and like every time someone flips the switch to transition from one of those systems, the feed gets totally shot for a while. And for whatever reason, some of them recover like within a month and they give us the back feed of data, but then we have one system, which I'd almost like to name, but it has like 16 different emergency departments under it, so it's a big system in our state. It's actually affecting a lot of our numbers at this point. They haven't submitted consistently for over a year. So when we do maps now, we actually have to gray out certain areas because we can't rely on the accuracy of that data. So anyway, this again helps us kind of prioritize some of these things. So the big take-home messages here are really improving E-codes will likely improve all coding. This is kind of a message we're trying to get out because, you know, if you just say E-codes, you know, and you want the E-codes, and particularly if they're not mandated, then it probably won't fall on everyone. But if you start talking about improving all of the coding, including E-codes, then we felt like we've gotten a better audience. Funding for quality improvement efforts are kind of rare, so we're trying to take advantage of this while we can. I'd love to say that CDC will support and expand some of these efforts in the future, but it's hard to know. The key stakeholders have been really supportive and have been willing to help, which has been great. And again, we're trying to take what we learned from the ED setting and apply it to the hospital discharge data in terms of some of the data structure and other things. And as you saw, we had this weird glitch where in the emergency department data, we have up to 6 fields for diagnosis and E-code. But for hospital, we only have 1 E-code. And it's literally because the file that they gave us 25 years ago, this is like Truven or whoever owns it now, that was how it was set up. And that's how they're going to give it to us in perpetuity, apparently. Although we've been negotiating with them recently, saying, look, we've got e-codes for ED, we know that they're there, we just need it in this other file. And so anyway, that was the example of the missing e-code data that we've been doing in North Carolina. And then I think we can just turn it over to questions for the entire group. So anyone from Holly to Tom to Barbara or whomever, if people have questions, let us know. Okay.
What impact do you expect that transition to IP encoding will have on these systems? I mean, do you think that will be a smooth transition, or
no.
Like a big drop off, or?
I mean, I think it's safe to say this is a huge transition and that it will not be smooth because it hasn't looked smooth so far. I will say that there are lots of people who are interested in making sure that it occurs, at least at this point, and that people have been doing, and other people can need to maybe respond to this as well, that there have been people working on kind of doing some prep work in terms of mapping some of the codes. And unfortunately, there's not like a direct map. You can't just say these codes are going to equal these codes. And so I'll let Barbara and Holly also, or are you going to sit up here? You guys all want to respond to this one? You want to respond to it a little bit?
So actually at the National Center for Health Statistics, we've been engaged quite a bit with this transition from ICD-9-CM to 10-CM. And I don't know if people are familiar with the external cause matrix and with the diagnosis matrix, the Burrell matrix, but we've done some substantial work over the last 2 years in creating ICD-10-CM versions of those two matrices, again, in preparation for people being able to consistently report for the external cause by mechanism and intent, or for diagnosis by nature of injury and body region. So as part of that work, we're also engaged with the Safe States Alliance to do another injury surveillance work group, ISW number 9, to help states get ready for this transition from 9-CM to 10-CM. And so Barbara, I think, is going to be leading that charge. And again, it's something that's just coming up. So we're going to start working on that probably within the next several months, get that started. And so probably a year from now is when we're likely to have some recommendations and some guidance around how to sort of work with the 10-CM coded data. I think we're all at a loss right at the moment because we don't have data to play with. So we're not quite sure what's going to happen. I do know in terms of the number of codes, in ICD-10-CM, the number of diagnosis codes went from 6,000 to over 73,000 diagnosis codes. For the external cause codes, I think there's over 2,000 now external cause codes. So the injury chapters, chapter 19 and 20 of the ICD 10-CM now encompass about 75% of all the codes in 10-CM. So it just exploded in the injury realm. And so what we don't know is whether there'll be enough documentation in the medical record to code to the level of specificity that's available in the codes, and whether or not people will just sort of look, do I really have to tell you it was the right toenail on the, you know, whatever that was twisted and bent and blah, blah, blah. So whether or not they'll really assign all those codes is still up to be seen. So I expect that data quality is going to take a dip for a few years and probably come back up. And external cause codes are still not reimbursable. So, you know, if they're taking even longer to code the record for that which they might get reimbursed, they might decide, now I really am not going to waste my time on the external cause code. So it's hard to say what's going to happen.
Well, do you know what was the experience of the transition on death certificates?
So death certificates is a totally different game, and actually we were having a conversation the other day about who was alive in the transition from 8-CM to 9-CM. You know, what lessons do we have from those folks? And there never was. There never was an 8-CM. So we don't have any past history to learn on in terms of the hospitalization data. For the mortality data, it was a little bit different because there wasn't such a huge explosion in the number of codes. The coding structure changed quite substantially, but they were also able to do what's called compatibility ratios and compatibility studies. So they took the same death certificate and they coded it in ICD-9 and ICD-10, and then they could sort of say, well, in the new world, you know, you need to sort of multiply by 1.2 and you'll get the same number as you had in the old world and that sort of thing. We don't have any dual coded data sets that allow us to do those comparability studies for hospitalization or for ED records, at least not yet. So, you know, again, in the first couple of years, I think that's what we're going to be talking about is, if we could do it, how would we do it? So, Barbara, I don't know if you have additional comments.
Just a couple comments. One is that you can start by checking with your hospitals and see if they have dual-coded data. I know that in Colorado, several hospitals did take a small number of records, coded them in ICD-9-CM and then in ICD-10-CM. And what I heard from our Colorado chapter of the Health Information Management Association is that it takes them three times as long to code in ICD-10-CM than it does in ICD-9-CM. Now, part of that's the learning curve, but normally they can code 21 inpatient records in a day, and they were only able to code 7 records in ICD-10-CM in a day. So that's a big shift in resources for hospitals. I also talked to our hospital association last week, and they are working with the individual hospitals on this transition, and they said they are getting dual-coded data to test, but it's not a lot of records per hospital. And Scott actually worked with one large hospital, and if you think about it, they're coding for all causes, or all types of medical conditions and treatment. And so there's very few injury records potentially in those dual-coded records. So that gives you some sense of the resources, even if we wanted to fund, somehow pool some money and fund someone to do the dual coding that we could then analyze. And then in the qualitative study we did, we asked our medical record reviewer to look at ED visits, and we gave the ICD-9-CM code, and then it took her on average 10 minutes to code in each record for two codes, the primary E code and the what she considered the major injury diagnosis. So on average 10 minutes to provide two codes back. And then for the inpatient records, she did not have the ICD-9-CM code as a reference, and it took her 20 minutes to provide both those codes. Now, a lot of the work we do, we're not asking our reviewers necessarily to do coding, but again, that gives you kind of an estimate to plan if you are asking reviewers. And then I pointed this slide out actually because I have a question for you as a group. The SQI work has one more year. One of the things we've talked about is just how to make all the lessons learned and all the individual studies and information available if people. So my question is, one, would people want this somewhere centrally, like on PH Connect, these types of things that have come out of these projects? Are there anything missing from that list?
Don't want it on PH
Connect. Yeah, don't put it on PH Connect. Okay, so I heard don't put it on PH Connect. Do you think we should ask CSTE if they would devote some of their website to kind of house this kind of information?
Did you read it?
It would be.
At least we'll know if either in a year. I'm sure we can.
And again, we don't have to necessarily put up all the actual documents, but we could at least tell you, you know, provide a spreadsheet that gives you a summary of what the project was, what's available for you, who the contact is. That might be something, you know, basic. And then you can talk to the person and find out what's really available. At a minimum, we kind of wanted to do a journal abstract format to summarize every single project. So that would give you basic information without having to, and a little more than that, you know, expanded contact list. But you wouldn't have this much detail on every project, and you wouldn't have to kind of cull through that. Yes, Dan?
I have always wanted, when you do any analysis, to provide
for any research project to revise the sample code so the state can just pick up the sample code and run with it. I think a lot of times you see papers and you're always wondering how they do it, what were their limitations, or what, you know, how did they cut the data? And you always just call the person. But I always thought it would be nice and just be like, oh, here's what we did, here's exactly how we did it. Sometimes it's tough for people to share their code, but you eventually, I was always stuck when I saw a paper like that. I was like, how did they do it? And you gotta ask them, they gotta tell you what steps. So I think it's up in the future. It should just be like, we're gonna put some code out there with it.
So Dan, if I understand you, if we were to put up any of the original documents, it might be to put up the SAS coding so people could just pull it and they don't have to ask for it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
See, that's the challenge, right?
And that you avoid using complex macros and things like that that are likely to throw a lot of people off.
Right, and that's also the challenge. You gotta worry if someone says this code works, if CFT puts it up on their website, is that they saying, well, this code works? Now, what if it doesn't work?
Yeah. You know, one idea that we have talked about, some of us, is just putting up the selection criteria, because who wants to type in all those ICD-9 or ICD-10 CM codes, right? So at least that part is correct.
Even if you put up just the meta code, like an English explanation of the logic used in the code, most people could then write their own code based upon that.
That's also a good suggestion for these projects. For the special emphasis reports and the indicators, I think that's what the guidance document does, is try to do both, tell you here's sort of the logic and then here's how you might do it. Not to the level of SAS code, but close enough that you could write good SAS program. Any other questions or suggestions for any of us?
I'm in trouble now.
I've never really, been thoroughly, knowledgeable about what happens to the special emphasis reports when we send them to the CDC. Do they use them internally? Do they just go to to Recaren and they just live there, or what happens?
I assume that they use them internally. I don't work at NCIPC. I work at NCHS, so I really don't know where they go once they get them. No, but Renee didn't sort of. But I do think that one of the values of having them have a standard look and format is that they can say, here's the funding that resulted in these 24 reports that all have a similar look, and so they can use them to argument for additional funding. So, to argue for additional funding. So I know they use it for that. Now, what else they do with them, I really don't know.
Well, I think for the poisoning one, at least when Len was working, he was interested in seeing those because it would be kind of at least a year and possibly even 2 years in advance of some of the data that he might have seen. So I think they were going to share them with the PDO team. I couldn't say the same for some of the other ones, but that would be the ideal, right? They get submitted, then they go to the right project officers who are involved, and the science officers who are involved in those potential projects, who then maybe give you feedback or maybe they're able to do kind of like a quick glance when they need, well, what are the things that other states are doing, or hey, someone, Dr. Frieden's going to North Carolina. What's North Carolina got? And then they can have a series of things they can pull out pretty quick. But that's what I've heard.
I also know that they did an evaluation of the first one on the infant and early childhood.
CDC did an evaluation of the first special emphasis report on infant and early childhood injuries, and that HRSA and the Maternal and Child Health Bureau participated in that. Those evaluation results are available. I was on a call where they sort of shared some of the results prior to the report, and HRSA and the Maternal Child Health Bureau were very excited to have that information and to be able to know that that information is in the states where they are also funding the McVee. So I think that they've served kind of different purposes, but I don't know exactly what HRSA or CDC has done. I know in our state, it's really a nice starting place when we get a general request, because people can look at that and they can form a better, more specific request if it doesn't meet their needs. And then the only other thing is, as I'm wearing my
epidemiology hat or my, but I'm not representing either CDC or the State Health Department when I say this. I sat in on all the listening sessions that CDC had, and it was clear that states are concerned about being overwhelmed in producing required special emphasis reports. And I heard a lot of good ideas. One is to sort of rotate them on a rotating schedule. Two is to let states pick and plan their own rotation of which reports to do when. And probably many of you were on those calls, and these might be your suggestions. So I think they really heard that, you know, increasing the number of required reports to be submitted to CDC is a challenge.
I'd also say if you're unfunded state and you're not funded by CDC to do injury, to getting that worksheet, the plain text file, it's like a plain Word file, and doing it on your own is a really good way to do a simple report that, for us, it solves like a lot of our issues. When you get a data request, you can just send a special emphasis report. So if you're not like with the CDC, you're not, you can just ask for that, hey, can we have that layout, and just input your own state data, and then just use that as your report. It's probably hard to do a report from scratch, so it's just, and it's a good report, I think, at the end of the day.
So can I ask a question of one of my co-speakers? Or is that not
That's
fair?
Allowed.
Do we have time? I mean, I don't know what time.
I think we're okay.
Well, actually, it's more of a comment, and it had to do with what Scott was presenting in terms of the emergency department data and looking at the external cause codes. And you had one figure up there that sort of showed you had a certain proportion that had the diagnosis only, or the E-code only, or the, you know, they had both, that sort of thing. And I just wanted to caution you that sometimes cases get assigned an external cause code, and you were concerned about they got the external cause code, but they didn't get the diagnosis code. And clearly, there can be times where people are admitted for observation, and you know they've been in the car crash. We're waiting to see if anything really develops. Do they really have any injuries? And sometimes they don't. So it makes it really hard to sort of assess if you have an E-code but no diagnosis code. Is that a data error versus it's a real event? So you could. You know, you could look at the spectrum of what are the external cause codes that don't have that. And if there are motor vehicle crashes or those types of things, typically it's because they were just watching them and seeing whether or not anything developed. So it's just something to keep in mind. Because we've talked about that before in terms of what should be the case definition for injury. You know, is it just based on diagnosis? Is it diagnosis and or E-code? And that was some of the conversation that we had because of, are you trying to count events or you're trying to count people who are injured? And so they better have a diagnosis of an injury. Just a comment.
The other thing along with those lines too is those activity codes don't necessarily need to have a diagnosis code.
Right.
So I know some of them are activity codes that are.
Yeah. Jennifer.
I was just wondering about the fall, the new template for fall.
Special emphasis
report.
Yeah.
Yeah. Any idea like how soon
like within
is?
The next month it is, isn't it?
You know, I don't know the answer to that, and I want to know it too.
Yeah.
I haven't seen the CDC published version. I have seen what Massachusetts was the lead on this one, and Utah, and it's really good, and you can see the evolution, and so I don't know if it's going to be required or not. I don't know when. Typically, they want this information out if they're going to require it by July 1st. If they're going to require it to be attached to the annual report due to the end of the budget year. Yeah,
so
budget cycle.
I don't know when it will be officially released, but I can tell you this. When Renee gave me her slides, and the slide for the fall report had that sort of brown box, she said, well, I have an updated slide, but it might be too late to, you know, exchange slides. So that means that it's been official. She can show you what the cover of the thing looks like. So to me, that's a hint that it's gotten through CDC clearance. Whether or not that means it's going to be released in the next month or 7 months or if it's going to be required, I don't know. But at least there's a new slide.
And
that's because my fall program really wants one, and I don't want to create one if I
Yeah, you don't want to create a new one. And what's really nice about this one is you, if you do the front page and the back page alone, it will cover a lot of audience. And so in Colorado, we're talking about doing both. So you can get it either as the two-pager or the four-pager. And it's going to meet a lot of needs. And I know that the fall stakeholders in Colorado, two of them, gave input in this process. And so they're waiting to get it, too. So it, so far, I think it's maybe the best one.
And it was shared with the CSC injury subcommittee, and some people reviewed and commented also.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, what
do
you
think?
So you've seen it.
I have, I know, and that's why I was wondering.
But it's 5:30, so I'm sure they may or may not want to stay around, but I don't want to keep you around. The session's over. Thank you all for coming. Enjoy tomorrow.